Fetal Abduction is a true crime podcast that explores cases of fetal abduction in America. Episodes contain descriptions of violence, which may not be suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to the first episode of Fetal Abduction, a true crime podcast about fetal abductions in America. I am your host, Erica Kelly. Season 1 of Fetal Abduction will cover 10 of these shocking cases, starting with the first known case in 1974. A fetal abduction is where a newborn is cut from their mother's womb. These crude C-sections are particularly gruesome and often end in death for the mother, the baby, or both. Sometimes the abductor does manage to remove the baby without harming him or her, and then they try to pass the baby off as their own. Sometimes this brutal crime is planned out carefully in advance, and sometimes it is spontaneous, almost a crime of convenience. The perpetrator has been thinking of stealing a baby in this heinous manner and spots a pregnant woman who has no idea what is about to happen to her. This first episode will feature the first known case of fetal abduction in the United States. There may have been cases before this one. In fact, it's very likely, but this is the first one on record. This abduction occurred in 1974, and as is common with older cases, some details are fuzzy or absent altogether. After the Freedom of Information Act request we filed was denied, our researchers pieced this story together using newspaper articles and ancestry resources. Margaret Ann Sweeney was born in the late 1940s. The exact date is unknown, and nothing is known about her childhood or upbringing apart from her father's name, William. It is known that Margaret lived in Philadelphia, and she was married to a man named James, but the couple separated in the early 1970s. By November 1974, Margaret had three daughters, Kim, Michelle, and Tammy, and she was 8 months pregnant with her fourth child. Her two older daughters lived with Margaret's father, William, in New Jersey, and would visit Margaret from time to time. 18-month-old Tammy still lived with her mother. The paternity of her children is unclear, and it is not known if any of the children were fathered by Margaret's ex-husband, James, or if he was even involved in their lives at all. But Margaret, a single mother in the 70s, seemed to be doing the best she could. There was a palpable stigma around single mothers back then, and despite that, Margaret was known to be a good parent. Her children were always clean, well-fed, and seemed happy. From newspaper accounts, Margaret didn't seem to face the judgment that so many single mothers of her time did. Around October of 1974, a heavily pregnant Margaret was in a hat store when she met Winifred Ransom. The pair struck up a conversation, and a friendship began. Winifred Margaret Ransom was born July 15, 1937, in Philadelphia, to parents Joseph and Margaret. Winifred had a partner, John, and while the pair never legally married, their relationship was a common law marriage. Winifred was known to be kind, and she loved children. She loved to talk to the neighborhood kids and give them candy. Winifred was desperate for a child. However, every time she told John she was pregnant, their elation turned to sorrow as Winifred never carried a baby to term. John estimated she told him about 6 or 7 miscarriages during their relationship. In 1974, Winifred announced she was pregnant once again, and this time, it looked like she would carry the baby to term. Her breasts and abdomen grew, she needed to wear maternity clothes, and her walk changed as her belly grew. She told her friends and family about the pregnancy, and they were elated for her. They would later be shocked to find out that Winifred was never really pregnant. Margaret Sweeney and Winifred Ransom bonded over their mutual interest in sewing and their pregnancies. Margaret trusted Winifred and believed that their babies were due around the same time. On November 13, 1974, Winifred invited Margaret and Tammy over to her West Philadelphia home to have lunch. During the visit, Margaret felt unwell, so she went to lie down in an upstairs bedroom while Winifred looked after Tammy in the living room. After Tammy fell asleep on the couch, Winifred went upstairs and began a brutal attack on Margaret. First, she knocked Margaret unconscious and used a knife to cut the baby out of her womb. Miraculously, the baby girl was unharmed. At some point during this barbarous C-section, Margaret regained consciousness. Winifred then attacked Margaret with a hatchet, hitting her 20 times before finally shooting her with a handgun at least 3 times. Sometime later, Winifred's nephew, Robert, arrived at the house and helped her to wrap up Margaret's body in a white sheet and a plastic sheet and then bury her under the floorboards. Robert then put Tammy, who had been in Winifred's house while her mother was murdered and buried, into Margaret's car. He then drove the toddler to North Philadelphia, where he abandoned the car with Tammy still in it. When John arrived home from work, Winifred told him that she'd had the baby while he was out and showed John the baby, telling him he had a daughter. John looked at Winifred's now flattened stomach and believed that Winifred had just given birth. But there was a clue that the baby was not Winifred and John's child. Winifred and John were both black, and the baby was white. However, John's grandfather was white, and one of his children was lighter skinned, so he did not question the fact that this baby was born white. Winifred ended up telling John that night that she killed Margaret, but in her story, Margaret initiated an attack on pregnant Winifred and tried to take Winifred's baby, so Winifred killed Margaret while defending her own baby. Even though his wife had just admitted to murdering someone, John did not go to the police with this information. Like many men, he loved his wife and wanted to believe her, and after so many losses and miscarriage, he probably wanted to protect his little family. At 5:30 p.m. on November 14th, over 24 hours after she was abandoned, Tammy was found in Margaret's station wagon. Apart from a slight fever and what appeared to be a mild cold, Tammy thankfully survived her ordeal with no serious injuries. The police ran the plates on the car and found that it belonged to Margaret Sweeney. When it was discovered that Margaret was not at home and her father didn't know where she was, the search for her began. 3 days later, John decided to go to the police and tell them about Winifred's confession. He told police that his conscience told him that it was the right thing to do. Armed with this information, police entered Winifred's house to conduct a search. They found Margaret's body in a shallow grave under the floorboards. They found her baby girl in one of the bedrooms, and she was taken to Philadelphia General Hospital to be checked over. The baby was well, apart from a mild case of jaundice, which is not uncommon in newborns. After being kept a week at the hospital for observation, the baby was released into the care of her grandfather, William, who had also taken custody of Tammy. William took the two girls back to New Jersey, where they were reunited with their sisters. He named the baby Margaret Teresa, after her mother. Winifred was arrested on November 17th, 4 days after the murder, and charged with murder, conspiracy, possessing an instrument of crime, and recklessly endangering another person. Her nephew Robert was arrested the same day, and he was charged with hindering an apprehension, conspiracy, and recklessly endangering another person. Despite our research, we could not find Robert's sentencing for his part in the crime. During questioning, Margaret told police that she was desperate to be a mother, but she was unable to have children of her own, so she came up with a plan to kill Margaret and take her baby. But then she changed her story, saying that Margaret had fainted and she cut the baby out because she was concerned for the baby's well-being. When Margaret woke up and started screaming, Winifred said she panicked and then killed her. Later, she would tell a different story, saying that she had been pregnant, but on the day of the murder, she had an abortion. This story prompted the district attorney to obtain an unorthodox search warrant, one that would require Winifred to submit to a gynecological exam. The DA wanted to prove that Winifred had never been pregnant and that her story about having an abortion on the day of the murder was a lie. After the exam, the gynecologist stated that Winifred had not recently been pregnant and had probably never been pregnant in her life. This information surprised Winifred's husband, John, who had held her hand as she told him about multiple miscarriages. However, he admitted that he had never had any real evidence that Winifred was pregnant, but he took her at her word. He never went with her to a prenatal appointment, he never saw any doctor's bills, and he had never been around during any of her miscarriages. This sort of blind faith on the part of a partner or husband is actually pretty common in these cases. They trust the woman they love, and they usually don't believe she is capable of such violence. Winifred was required to undergo psychological testing at Byberry State Hospital to ensure she was fit to stand trial. This may have been due to the nature of the crime, her changing stories, or because she had faked so many pregnancies, or perhaps for all of these reasons. There seems to be no question that Winifred was a very troubled woman, but the doctors decided that she was competent and ready to stand trial. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Winifred's trial began on July 2, 1975, and was held in the Common Pleas Court in Philadelphia. She adopted for a non-jury trial, which meant the judge would decide her fate. Judge Juanita Kidd Stout oversaw Winifred's trial. She was the first Black female judge in Pennsylvania and the first Black woman in the country to serve on a state Supreme Court. Winifred's attorney entered a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. A psychiatrist, Jan Grossman, from Byberry State Hospital, testified to Winifred's mental state leading up to and during the crime. In Dr. Grossman's opinion, Winifred's inability to conceive and carry a child led her to a psychotic delusion. He argued that, during the murder and abduction, Winifred was unable to discern right from wrong. As supporting evidence, Dr. Grossman told the jury of Winifred's long history of mental illness, specifically schizophrenia with paranoid tendencies, which had resulted in Winifred hearing voices. This may seem confusing as Dr. Grossman came from Byberry, the hospital that had deemed Winifred competent to stand trial. But the legal insanity defense goes by the defendant's state of mind at the time of the crime, not any ongoing mental issues. During the short trial, Winifred admitted to killing Margaret and cutting the baby from her womb. The trial concluded on June 10th, with Judge Kidd Stout finding Winifred not guilty by reason of insanity. Judge Kidd Stout sent Winifred to Byberry State Hospital, where she was committed. Byberry State Hospital, also known as the Philadelphia State Hospital at Byberry, has a long and disturbing history. It was a dedicated psychiatric facility located in Northeast Philadelphia that operated from 1911 until 1990. The hospital was privately owned until 1938, when the state took over running it and other similar facilities due to numerous scandals. It is the type of psychiatric facility that you've seen in horror movies. It was notorious for overcrowding, unexplained deaths, and patient abuse. The hospital had room for 2,000 patients, but by 1947, there were typically three times as many patients there. At the height of its occupancy in the late 50s, there were 6,500 patients, with a staff of only 1,000, spread over 50 buildings. In 1962, President Kennedy called for deinstitutionalization, which resulted in psychiatric facilities releasing patients and minimizing bed numbers. Byberry released a third of their patients over the next decade, and by the mid-70s, their funding had dwindled, and they were struggling to keep the doors open. Just after Winifred was admitted, the hospital stopped accepting new patients and were sending some patients to other facilities, or just letting them go. Horrific stories leaked out of Byberry Hospital. At best, these were stories of negligence. At worst, torture and abuse. Patients were subjected to medical and cosmetic testing in the 50s and 60s, and many patients died from a complete lack of care. By Christmas of 1975, the doctors thought Winifred had improved enough to be released for a few days so she could spend the holidays with her family. This request was submitted and was denied by Judge Kid Stout and the District Attorney's Office. Only 2 months later, Byberry Hospital requested Winifred be transferred to another facility where she would receive outpatient care. Due to the nature of the crime she had committed barely a year earlier, this request was again denied by both Judge Kid Stout and the DA's office. In December of 1976, the psychiatrist at Byberry once again recommended Winifred be transferred to an outpatient facility. They declared her sane and said that her schizophrenia was managed and she no longer needed to be in a full-time facility. Because the psychiatrist had declared Winifred sane, Judge Kid Stout and the DA's office did not have the authority to hold her in the facility any longer. The judge stated that she could not comprehend the decision to declare Winifred sane, and any negative actions after the release would be the responsibility of the facility. Basically, the judge left the hospital open for civil liability due to their decision, and it's a safe bet that this decision was influenced by overcrowding and other issues ongoing at Byberry. The public outcry was enormous. People made signs and protested the decision to grant the release of a woman who had, 2 years before, viciously murdered a woman and abducted her baby. Winifred was released in early 1977. In February of that year, she legally changed her name to Frieda Howard and seemed to drop off the radar and out of the minds of the people of Philadelphia. In August of 1987, she changed her name again, this time to Frieda Furman. On August 4th, 1997, Winifred Ransom, now Frieda Furman, died at the age of 60. Margaret's four daughters were raised in New Jersey by their maternal grandfather. After the murder of their mother faded in the press, Margaret's daughters were able to live their lives in privacy. According to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, infant abductions pertain only to the kidnapping of a child of up to 1 year of age. The statistics for fetal abduction are included in the infant abduction statistics, as the center does not record the numbers separately. Further muddying the numbers, the statistics on infant abduction include both non-custodial parent and stranger abductions. Infant abduction is rare, and fetal abduction even more so. According to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, there have been 327 confirmed infant abductions between 1964 and 2019. Confirmed is the key word. The center is not notified on all infant abductions, and their statistics are based solely on what is reported to them. Of the 327 confirmed abductions, 140 were taken from a healthcare facility, 140 were abducted from their home, and 47 were taken from other locations. 315 of the abductors were women, with most being in their 20s. 39 abductions resulted in the mother's death, and 10 resulted in the death of the child. Most children who are abducted are reunited with their families. However, 15 infants under 6 months of age are listed as missing at the time of this recording. Infant abductions appear to be on the rise, according to Kathy Nerhierny, who is the senior analyst of infant abduction for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. She believes that technology and access to information could be a factor. It's easier than ever to download a sonogram photo and fake a pregnancy, and information on how to perform a C-section can be found online. Social media websites and those listing goods and services, such as Craigslist, make it easier for abductors to find targets and gather information. Prior to technology being such an integral part of our lives, this information was much harder to come by. Modern abductors can find their victims through Facebook buy and sell groups looking for baby clothes, as well as other groups like for expectant mothers. In 1974, if Winifred Ransom hadn't met Margaret Sweeney at that hat shop and forged a friendship, she may never have committed such a heinous crime. It's difficult to describe a typical infant abductor. Not all abductors will have the same traits, but there are commonalities. The following is a list of common traits compiled by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. The abductor is usually female and of childbearing age, and she may have at least one child of her own. She might also have a history of being compulsive and manipulative, and she is most often in a relationship with someone who wants a baby. Sometimes it is a woman who just wants a baby with her unwitting partner. The person they are in a relationship with usually has no role in the abduction and genuinely believes that their partner has been pregnant and given birth to the baby. And there is often an age difference between the abductor and their partner. These abductors often kidnap a child or baby close to their home, and they may have visited hospitals and other facilities to memorize the layout and to familiarize themselves with the medical staff in order to plan the abduction. The abduction is often planned, however, a specific infant is not, and they sometimes pose as a healthcare worker, and the abductor is often able to care for the infant once they have brought it home. And usually, skin color is a factor, and the infant that is abducted is the same race as the abductor or their partner, but not always. Winifred fits into many of these categories, particularly that her husband believed that this was his child, even though the baby girl was white. And newspapers spoke of Winifred seeming to have gained weight. Some abductors will use padding to fake a pregnancy, and sometimes they may actually suffer from pseudocyesis. This is a condition in which the woman truly believes she is pregnant and even manifests symptoms, including morning sickness, sore and engorged breasts, and even abdominal distension. Considering Winifred's psychiatric assessment, it's possible she suffered from pseudocyesis, but we cannot be sure. That term was not used in Winifred's trial. It was already a recognized psychiatric diagnosis, but her attorney may have felt that it was too obscure to use at trial. Her psychiatrist did claim that at the time she murdered Margaret, she was unable to tell right from wrong. But it takes a great deal of willpower to murder a human being, and even more to cut open a woman's belly, to steal the child in her womb. Fetal Abduction is hosted and edited by me, Erica Kelly. It's written by Jessica Ann and researched by Haley Gray and Kim Fritz. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and the original music and audio engineering is by Chez Gray of Gray Multimedia. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. We are also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify. If you have any case suggestions, please email fetalabductionpod@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back in 2 weeks with a new fetal abduction case.